The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England.
World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Word of
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There are a number of tools and research papers advising teachers on how to best engage introverted students in school. With K-12 education increasingly focused on group learning and collaborative skills, an active, noisy classroom can be a real challenge for introverts, especially when they're the teacher. Michael Godsey is a teacher based in St. Louis Obispo, California, also a contributing writer for The Atlantic, where he wrote about the high burnout rate for introverted teachers and what a loss that is for solitary or withdrawn kids. Michael Godsey, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So you've met a number of introverted teachers. Do you think they knew what they were getting into?
I think a lot of times there's a sometimes a romantic expectation that there's going to be a lot of reading. I think a lot of readers get into teaching, and I'm an English teacher, so even more with English teachers. Reading and hanging out with people that enjoy reading and book clubs and writing quietly and grading papers, you know, under the lamp, things like that. And then other teachers get into it because they love working with kids. I think there's a broad spectrum, but I think those are the two poles there.
Mm. Well, you mentioned in your article a couple of studies suggesting that introverted teachers are in danger of burning out. What are some of the big challenges for them?
Especially the first 2 years, it's constantly interacting with people and in meetings and in a lot of small talk and a lot of collaboration. And the more introverted you are, the more that you're not ever anti-people. It's just exhausting. And especially the first 2 years, I wouldn't call myself an introvert, and it just exhausted me. It was just new meetings because you got to meet new people. So you got to meet the parents, you got to meet the administration. You're constantly being observed, department meetings, union meetings, collaborative meetings within your department, and then they get you a mentor because they think that helps. But then you're meeting with mentors all the time and senior teachers and things like that, and it's tough. And it's funny, once you get tenure and nobody's observing you as much, you get a lot more quiet time. Hmm. But you got to make it through that first couple of 3 years, and that's when teacher attrition is just really high. It's 41% or something in the first 2 years.
Yeah, so orientation is tough on anybody, but especially introverted teachers. Anecdotally, I've talked with a lot of teachers who've mentioned, you know, there are a lot of meetings, there's a lot of training and workshops, and there's this pressure to be always active and engaged with students and parents. You point to a term in your article coined by the Harvard Business Review. Have we, Michael Godsey, reached collaborative overload?
I think in some environments, I hear it from a lot of people, I see it in little spots. I like the high school I'm at. We haven't overloaded here, but in just like the what you just cited, they're talking about the business world, and I've talked to lots of people in business that are forced into group tables and group rooms where they're always in a collaborative situation, and they say it just exhausts them. It's the same way, I think, with teaching, except we go from those meetings right into another classroom where the kids are expected to be engaged in a collaborative manner a lot of times.
So in general, teachers do have to learn how to recharge. How is it different for introverted teachers?
I think they need to know that it's okay. A lot of them, I read a lot, they're like, whew, you just described me, and I thought I was weird. Like, I thought it was just me. I thought there was something wrong with me. I mean, I didn't know about it until I studied a lot more and started talking to teachers, and then I started seeing teachers quite a bit in their room, sometimes the lights off, at lunchtime or after school, just decompressing. And usually they don't know that that's common. They think it's them or there's something wrong with them. And they don't stick up for themselves and say, hey, this is something that I really need. This is a thing. One or two teachers I do know are very aware of it, and they're much more healthy about it.
So do they last?
No, my favorite, that's what I was kind of worried about. I mean, we lost one of the guys I know that spent 2 hours a day in his room quietly all the time. He's moved on to a quieter school. Another guy quit. He was a brand-new teacher. I mentioned Mr. Lovegren, who doesn't work around here, but he said he finally quit after 12 years. He couldn't handle it anymore. And he was very conscious of it. He knew, like, I can't take it anymore. I have to have the space, and I'm not getting that space.
So what does that mean for kids?
Well, the bummer for the kids is that I think they're losing that type of teaching, which is really good for kids. I notice that now that I'm more aware of it, I notice how much my kids like at least a designated quiet time, that they like to interact, they love to socialize, but when I tell them to be quiet and read for a half an hour or we do a quiet activity, I'm recognizing they really like it. And so if we lose those introverted teachers or those that are sensitive to that, I think we lose that for the kids. And also I think they lose role models. Like I said, I think there's that idea that I like to read, so I'm going to be a teacher when I grow up. Mm. Or I like to think and reflect in my journal, and so I might want to be a teacher when I grow up. And I think that the more they see these role models that are very active and facilitating and collaborating, and that they'll think that's what teaching is. And then I think that will just get more and more extreme as we progress.
Do you remember, Michael, there was a book a couple of years ago about the power of introverts? I'm trying
sure.
to remember the woman's name. Susan Cain.
Susan Cain.
Right. She is an introvert herself and made the point that they are not as highly valued as extroverts. So it is a much bigger problem. How do you think to encourage introverts as both teachers and students within the school system?
I just think recognition and awareness is really important. There's still the stereotype of that they are being withdrawn or they're antisocial or they're lazy. And I think there's a lot of teachers in particular, but I think it's every profession, that feel bad when they say, well, I just spent a whole day with kids and now I'm in a meeting where I'm supposed to do an icebreaker and get engaged in a lot of small talk and I'm just exhausted. So I think it's just the awareness more than anything. And the article I cited had a lot of good advice for schools. John Spencer wrote a piece on how to give those teachers the space and just to be aware. One of his pieces of advice was just ask them, like, what's best for you? Where do you get charged up? Where are you the better teacher? I see it with coaches, too. It's even more dramatic. So you'll see really extroverted, excitable coaches, because I coach basketball and baseball, and other ones that are deeply introverted. And as long as they're playing to their strengths, the kids love them and they play hard for them.
Michael Godsey, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Sure. My pleasure.
Michael Godsey is a teacher. He's based in St. Louis Obispo, California, also a coach, and he's also a contributing writer for The Atlantic. That's where he wrote about the high burnout rate for introverted teachers. You can find a link to read the article at wordofmouthradio.org. They are the most literal signs of desperation. Cash for your gold. We buy ugly houses. And for those in the upper crust, cash for your Warhol. Quick settlements, no questions asked. That sign began popping up in American cities during the Great Recession. The prank slash art installation is now a fake business with a real storefront and genuine competition. I'll let Jeff Hargadon, he's a conceptual artist, financial advisor, and the brains behind Cash for Your Warhol, explain. Hello, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, but what a great story here. This Cash for Your Warhol thing, it's been going on since 2009. What started it for you?
Well, we were in the middle of the financial crisis, and I kept seeing so many of these signs, cash your house, cash for this and that. Everywhere. It seemed like an assault on our senses from all telephone poles all over. It just popped in my head one time, what about the 1%? What about their liquidity needs? And the phrase cash for your Warhol just popped in my head. I thought, well, I think I'm just going to make a bunch of signs and see what happens.
So people called you?
Oh, yeah. The first set of signs that I did actually had my mobile number on it, which was a mistake. I thought everybody would be in on the joke, but no, not everybody was. I eventually migrated to a Google Voice number where all the calls are archived.
Mm. I go to your website and it says, Cash for Your Warhol has been business for several months.
That needs to be updated, I guess.
It says it will help you manage your finances, increase liquidity, manage child support obligations, and get on with your life. So people were called. Were they in on the joke?
There were the calls that I get are curiosity seekers. They are people who just want to know if it's a real number, the people who want to talk about the project. And I get a surprising amount of people who actually have Warhols that they want to sell.
Really? Well, so is that the measure of success for you, how many people you fool?
I'm not sure how to define success with this project. For me, it's just being part of a broader conversation about art and art as commodity, and it's a little bit anti-establishment. It's really about how art has been commodified. And the more people talk about that, the more successful it is. But I'm really not trying to fool people. That's why I put my cell phone number on there on the first sign. I figured everybody would get it.
And now you have a storefront. So what's in there?
Well, the store is designed in such a way that for people who have Warhols that they want to bring in and sell, they now have a place to go. We're exclusively dealing in Warhols. And the way the store is set up is it's meant to look very much like a pawn shop. It's also really an art installation that can be viewed from the sidewalk. So while I'm not there, people can walk by and pretty much see the whole thing.
I noticed that I was looking at photographs on the Boston Globe. They had a little slideshow of the store. And there are fake checks you made out, cash for your Warhols made out to people.
Are they,
I'm assuming they're fake. Let's put it that way.
Well, I will say this. Some of the stuff in the store is real and some of it is not real. And I leave it up to the viewer to decide what's what.
Well, now you have competition, apparently. As I was looking you up online, there are other Cash for Your Warhol businesses that are being set up.
That is right. Friends of mine were Googling Cash for Your Warhol and noticed that one site, Cash for Your Warhols, with an S at the end, had popped up. And the website is actually near replica of my site, except it's a real business. It's run out of California. I actually hired a lawyer to present them with a cease and desist order, not because I'm so mad, but because I thought it would be kind of fun for a fake business to try to stop a real business from, imposing on my fake business. And it's actually worked. We just heard back from them recently. We're in the process of negotiating a settlement, and we're pretty pleased with the results. And in fact, the whole process of the cease and desist order might end up being another spin-off of the project.
Well, I was thinking that. I also read that there's going to be a show of the signs at a gallery, I think, in Philadelphia or something like that.
Yeah, and we actually was in April of 2015. We had a show of all the signs that have been designed at that point, and it was really fun to see them all on a wall, framed up, all dressed up for the big show.
So you've got a storefront now. You've actually got a cease and desist business against a real business for getting in the way of your fake business. Where do you go from here, Jeff?
I don't know. My philosophy is if I have an idea and it sounds reasonably good, I'm going to put it out there and just see what happens. Mm-hmm. I don't really expect anything to be financially successful or critically acclaimed. If I have an idea, I want to throw it out and enjoy the process and kind of see where it goes. And this project has been, it's been amazing. Some of the things that have happened as a result of it. And it wouldn't have happened if I hadn't just made up that initial set of signs and my cell phone number on it and started putting them on telephone poles.
Mm.
So it's been really enjoyable.
So you're doing it. I mean, I can't help but think that Andy Warhol would think this is pretty funny.
Well, I never knew Andy, but I've come to know people who did know Andy Warhol, and they tell me that he would have enjoyed it.
Jeff Hargadon, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Jeff Hargadon, he's a conceptual artist, and he's a financial advisor from Somerville, Mass. Cash for Your Warhol now has a storefront at Inman Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts. There's much more on the store, including a slideshow that's from the Boston Globe. There's a link to that at wordofmouthradio.org.
Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all. Andy Warhol, let's just scream, hang him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen, can't tell them apart at all.
With presidential primary stakes heating up in New Hampshire, candidates are pulling out all the stops at rallies and town halls to get voters fired up. This includes playing songs with not such subtle messages and usually a signature anthem when the candidate takes the stage. But what if those songs are used without permission? Can that be considered fair use? Michael Olivas, the rock and roll law professor, looks back at some of the most famous cease and desist cases.
It's a legal matter, baby. A legal matter from now on.
Hitting the campaign trail or cease and desist from playing my song. Class number 17. As the endless cycle of election day appears, especially in presidential campaigns, candidates try as they might to identify with the people and have the people identify with them. One of the more common campaign devices is to use a popular song as part of the candidate's public image. While anyone who wishes to sing someone else's song may do so, provided appropriate fees are paid to the composer, using a particular version of the performer's rousing song is another matter. If a given performer does not like the politics of the person using the song, he or she can invoke performance copyright protections and deny the use of that particular version of the song by the campaigner. This often takes the form of a public shaming and a request that the campaign not use the song. If that doesn't work, the situation can escalate to a cease and desist order. If the matter is still unresolved, it can lead to a lawsuit to prevent use of the song. By a rough count, almost 24 songs have been banned from use in a political campaign. The number one violator, Senator John McCain from Arizona, who was refused by more than 6 singers. For example, during his 2008 presidential campaign, McCain was contacted by John Mellencamp over his unauthorized use of Our Country and Pink Houses, even though the singer allowed Democrat John Edwards to use the song. McCain also misused the Foo Fighters' My Hero, Van Halen's Right Now, and Orleans' Still the One. McCain was also issued a cease and desist order from ABBA, not letting him use Take a Chance on Me. Now, when Sarah Palin used Hart's Barracuda, she was also asked by the group to stop doing so. Mike Huckabee was asked by Boston not to use More Than a Feeling, but here I would have offered a special exception to Huckabee, who as governor of Arkansas had actually pardoned a speeding ticket in the state against the Stones' Keith Richards. Most of the artists who were violated issued public objections. In my view, the best refusal has to be that of Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello, who wrote a sarcastic op-ed denouncing Paul Ryan for even saying how much he liked Rage's music. Ryan's running mate, Mitt Romney, was also bitten by a band when he tried to use Silver Sun Pickup's Panic Switch and was later sent a cease and desist letter. In addition to losing in the 2012 GOP presidential primary, Newt Gingrich also lost when he was ordered to stop using two songs, Survivor's Eye of the Tiger and The Heavy's How Do You Like Me Now? Hey Newt, how do you like me now? In earlier campaigns, Ronald Reagan was sent a cease and desist letter by Bruce Springsteen for his misappropriating Born in the USA, as was George H.W. Bush, W.'s father, for his campaign's use of Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy. Several of these disputes resulted in actual litigation after the artist's efforts to stop the unauthorized use of the song failed. In one great example, Florida Governor Charlie Crist was sent a cease and desist order by David Byrne and the Talking Heads for their song, Road to Nowhere, in his U.S. Senate campaign. Crist kept using the song, and so Byrne sued him over unauthorized usage, and the judge ordered Crist to go on YouTube and issue a public and often visited apology for his transgression. Jackson Brown successfully sued John McCain, who else, for his use of Running on Empty and received an undisclosed settlement for his performance copyright. Now, what patterns evidence here? Virtually all of these rock songs were withheld from national Republican campaigns. A number of country stars have supported GOP candidates, as has rock and roller Ted Nugent. I could only find one public cease and desist order ever issued against a Democrat candidate, President Obama, who was asked not to use Hold On, I'm Coming by the lead singer of Sam and Dave, Sam Moore. Now, Moore did not allow any politicians to use his music, as he had also refused permission earlier to allow Bob Dole to use his song, Soul Man, for a parody version, Dole Man. What's the point, Bob? If you're a Democrat, your rock and roll catalog's waiting for you. If you're a Republican, you'd better like country music or be a fan of Ted Nugent.
And that was Michael Olivas, professor at the University of Houston Law Center, otherwise known as the Rock and Roll Law Professor. Well, this election cycle has seen its fair share of artists balking at politicians using their music. Pop superstar Adele publicly announced through a spokesperson that she has not given permission for her music to be used for any political campaigning. That was after Donald Trump played Rolling in the Deep and the theme from Skyfall at some of his rallies. Trump has also come under fire from Aerosmith for using Dream On, and REM delivered an expletive-laden rant after Trump played their song, It's the End of the World as We Know It, and I Feel Fine. Trump does appear to have an ally in the rapper Azalea Banks, who publicly endorsed the candidate on Twitter this week. So maybe we'll be hearing more of her music at his events.
Hey, I can be the answer. I'm ready to dance when the vampire...
And in December, Marco Rubio's campaign was issued a cease and desist from the Swedish EDM duo Axwell and Ingrosso for playing their song, Something New, at his campaign stops.
I see the dawn of a new...
Perhaps the answer to not running afoul of musicians and their copyrights is for candidates to release an album of their own.
The banks are made of marble, with a guard at every door.
That unmistakable voice is none other than Senator Bernie Sanders performing Pete Seeger's union song, The Banks Are Made of Marble. It's from his 1987 album, We Shall Overcome. Politics and music have been known to mix. Take then-Governor Bill Clinton playing saxophone on the Arsenio Hall show in 1992. Or now former candidate Mike Huckabee jamming on the bass with his band Capital Offense. Though the Bernie Sanders folk album may be among the most perplexing. Here to shed some light on how the then-Burlington, Vermont mayor, Bernie Sanders, found himself in the music studio is Anthony Fisher. He reviewed the album for Reason.com. And Anthony, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So how did this album come to be?
Well, the owner of a local Burlington studio was just looking for any excuse to book some sessions in his studio. He was well connected with a lot of local studio musicians, was a big fan of then Burlington Mayor Bernie Sanders' politics, and just thought it would be a fun idea to pair him up with some of these local musicians and in a project that he described as Vermont's answer to We Are the World, which for those of your listeners who might be under the age of 35, was the Michael Jackson, Lionel Richie supergroup created as a benefit record for African famine relief in 1985. I don't know that they had a specific cause or charity in mind, but Bernie Sanders was open to doing it. And it didn't take too long for them to realize that Bernie had no rhythm and was basically tone deaf. So they got rid of the original plan, which was to have him actually sing all the songs. And instead, you know, in his unmistakable cadence, as you heard, chose to speak the lyrics and even in some of the cases present some of his own spoken word original prose to go along with the session musicians who some of whom would later sing their own vocals on the tracks.
Your quote from the studio owner Todd Lockwood in your article said, "This is a guy who couldn't even tap his foot to music coming over the radio."
I mean, Bernie is not. It's funny that compared to Barack Obama's insurgent candidacy in 2008, where he was all polish and glamour, Bernie is disheveled. Bernie is the opposite of glamour, and yet that appears to be his appeal: is the authenticity of schlubbiness.
Well, let's hear just a little bit more from his album. This is Bernie Sanders' version of "Where Have All the Flowers Gone."
Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time passing. Where have all the soldiers gone? Long time ago. Where have all the soldiers gone? Gone to graveyards, everyone. When will they ever learn? When will they ever learn?
It's hard not to think of Larry David doing Bernie, doing this album in some way. How was the album received at the time?
It wasn't really received much at all. It didn't really go much further past the Burlington region. At one point, I think the guy who owned the studio had no original copies of the record himself. It had pretty much just sunk without a trace. And even with Bernie's ascendance into Congress, it didn't really resurface until very recently.
Well, I imagine the Sanders campaign would want this to remain sunken without a trace. How have they reacted to this album coming back out?
They've tried their best to ignore it. It's actually popped up a bunch over the past year, although in the last week or so, it's gotten a lot of attention. Like Jimmy Fallon actually played it on his show. I believe an ABC reporter played it for Bernie. And even though Bernie has gone on the record saying that it was a huge mistake to participate in this record, when the cameras were on him and somebody was playing the record for him, he joked that he was trying to get in the groove and didn't want to be distracted. And he had a very good sense of humor about it.
Okay, I want to move to a lighter topic, if you don't mind. We've got something to play for you. Does this sound familiar?
I'm getting in the groove here. Does sound very familiar. 25 years old.
Okay, so out of 4 stars, what do you think you'd give the album, Anthony?
I mean, musically, I'd got to give it a 1. It's pretty, you know, the musicianship, you know, is certainly competent but uninspired. Bernie, you know, is a terrible singer with no rhythm. But if I was grading on a curve as far as just a novelty record, it's a 4. It's an absolute classic. No matter what happens, whether Bernie gets the nomination or not, this is a political totem that I hope does not get forgotten down the memory hole.
Anthony Fisher, a writer and producer for Reason.com and for Reason TV, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much.
And you can find a link to Anthony's review of Bernie Sanders' folk album. You can hear some of the cuts for yourself at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw above me that endless skyway.
Boy, for equal time, I wish we could find something of Hillary Clinton singing off-key.
Yeah, that'd be good. I think she's been much more careful with her with what she puts out into the world over the last few decades.
Anthony, thank you so much. Really appreciate your time. So in the interest of fairness, we did a little digging around and discovered that Hillary Clinton has indeed sung publicly. Here's a clip of then First Lady Hillary Rodham Clinton on the Rosie O'Donnell Show in 1997.
Well, now, I don't know. I know you're busy. You can't watch the show every day, but I tend to sing occasionally.
I've heard that. I've actually seen you sing.
You have? Yeah.
I have. I've
seen was wondering
show.
If you perhaps might want to do a little Bye Bye Birdie with me.
Do you think anybody will hear me?
No one will hear.
Okay,
no.
So nobody hears me. I'll be okay.
All right. Take it, John. You
Hi,
jump
Nancy.
Right. All right. Sorry. I stepped on your line. Go again. My fault. Go.
Hi, Nancy.
Hi, Helen.
What's the story? Morning glory.
What's the tale? Nightingale.
Tell me quick about Hugo and Kim.
Hi, Margie.
Hi, Alice.
What's the story? Morning glory.
What's the word? Hummingbird.
Have you heard about Hugo and Kim?
Did they really get pinned?
Oh, yeah.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 1952 presidential campaign pitted the immensely popular General Dwight David Eisenhower against the ferociously intellectual and intensely private Adlai Stevenson. It was an election fought on a new battleground, television. This story is part of the Contenders series, portraits of some of America's most original presidential candidates, produced by Radio Diaries.
My name is Newton Minow. In 1952, I worked as assistant legal counsel to Governor Adlai Stevenson.
Stevenson's
only one, and he wears no boss's coat.
My name is Adlai Stevenson, Adlai Stevenson III. I'm the son of Adlai Stevenson II, who ran for president of the United States in 1952.
We were in the midst of the Korean War. President Harry Truman was extremely unpopular. The country's view of the Democratic Party was very, very low. The opponent on the Republican side was General Dwight Eisenhower, who was one of the most beloved, popular persons in the country. He had won the war for the American people. He could have had the nomination of either party.
Yeah, it was shaping up to be a very difficult year for the Democrats.
Until a few months ago, the name of Adlai Stevenson meant little to the people of the United States.
My name is Jean Baker, and I wrote the book The Stevensons, a biography of an American family. Adlai Stevenson had been the governor of Illinois, but he had not been involved in politics for very long.
But he was very well educated. He had gone to Princeton, and he had written and spoken a great deal. And Adlai believed that a political campaign is an educational process. It's an education for the voter, and it's an education for the candidate.
And so Stevenson decides to go throughout the country and create a informative, moving seminar for the voters. Here's what he said. Let's talk sense to the American people.
Governor Adlai Stevenson, who receives an enthusiastic welcome in Baltimore, the governor expresses himself forcefully on the subject of taxes.
I don't like taxes. I doubt if anybody does. I shall do everything I can to reduce them, but I shall make no promises that I know I cannot keep.
He had great faith in the public, great faith in the voters. Adlai believed that you don't just tell them what they want to hear, you tell them the truth.
And I'll bank on the American people. I'll bank on them even in an election year to understand straight talk and the need for a balanced budget in this country.
Adlai Stevenson's strength, which was these brilliant speeches that he gave, during the presidential campaign against Eisenhower, they became a liability.
Ike for president, Ike for president. You like Ike, I like Ike. Everybody likes Ike for president. Hang out the banner, beat the drum. We'll take Ike to Washington.
The people who did the Eisenhower campaign were Madison Avenue advertising executives. My name's David Schwartz. I'm the chief curator of the Museum of the Moving Image. It was Rosser Reeves who was most famous for Eminem melts in your mouth, not in your hands. He's the one who really knew that you could kind of boil a campaign down to a little soundbite or a jingle. And millions of people saw that ad and decided they liked Ike.
We'll take Ike to Washington.
Vote for Eisenhower.
Adlai Stevenson, he didn't really believe in things like this. Stevenson just didn't even like the idea of commercials at all. He just felt like, you know, you shouldn't try to sell a presidential candidate the same way you would sell cereal or soap. He just thought this is not what politics is about.
For more than 23 centuries, humanity has striven to attain the ideal.
The Stevenson campaign decided early on that they would buy 30-minute blocks of time on TV and he would do speeches, 30-minute speeches.
If each of us lives up to the moral and the ethical obligations of citizenship.
But nobody tuned in to watch them.
Adlai Stevenson goes west. The Democratic candidates tour includes stops and speeches in Wyoming, Utah, Oregon, Washington, and Texas.
He was on a platform campaigning, and a photographer below the platform took a photograph, which included the sole of his shoe, which had a hole in it. And that photograph became a symbol of this man who, you know, really was thinking more about the issues than he was his shoes. And it caught on, and suddenly buttons were sprouting with, you know, in the shape of a shoe with a hole in it.
I'd rather have a man with a hole in his shoe than a hole in everything he says.
The symbol that many people have held is that Stevenson is frugal. Look, here's his candidate, and he even walks around with holes in his shoe. But the real story of that photograph is that Stevenson, moments before he's going to give this speech, he's not doing what politicians usually do. They point in the second row to Betty, who's helped him on the campaign trail, or Harold, who they think is in charge of the local newspaper. But Stevenson does none of that. He's looking down at his text and making corrections.
This is the final night before one of the most vital elections in the history of our country. Tomorrow, you, the voter, will make the final decision.
On the eve of the election, Stevenson intended to make this last speech one of his best.
Looking back, I am not wholly content that I have said, or said well, everything that was in my heart. Talking sensibly and honestly is not always easy. It means saying things that sometimes people don't like to hear. It means risking votes. And candidates are not supposed to do that.
He's into this brilliant end of campaign speech. But they had only paid for 30 minutes, and time ran out.
People who still believe in one another, in spite of all the timid, doubting men.
And what the viewers saw at home was Stevenson still talking, but they cannot hear him.
You know, he probably wasn't paying any attention to the red lights that were going on and off and the hands that were being waved at him. He was concentrating on his message, and he didn't want to cut it short.
Electric signs flash the news, lights in, and bedlam breaks out amongst the Republican supporters as they hear of their landslide victory.
The victory for Eisenhower was overwhelming. I think Adlai carried just a few states. He was never bitter about it. Oh, he wanted to win, of course. But I heard him say this more than once. There are worse things that can happen to a person than losing an election.
We're gonna choose the gov that we love. He is the gov nobody can.
And that story was part of the series Contenders, Portraits of America's Most Original Presidential Candidates, and was produced by Joe Richman and Samara Freemark of Radio Diaries. Some people build their dream houses. Others deliberately build nightmares. Why? Pure, unadulterated spite. People who have both plenty of money and a vast supply of vengeance can erect the built equivalent of a giant middle finger aimed at neighbors, siblings, town officials, or ex-spouses. Garishly painted, squished into tiny lots, or sitting empty in remote places, they are called spite houses and are often the stuff of legends. Patrick Sisson is editor at Curbed and wrote about 12 such houses created with anger and angst. And Patrick, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks.
So how would you define a spite house?
Well, there's a lot of different examples. I think it's something that is really just meant as a way to inconvenience or just disappoint your neighbor. It's really meant as a bit of sort of built revenge that, of course, by the nature of being a home, ends up sticking around for a lot longer than people may expect, or at least longer than people are still angry.
So is there a typical look to a spite house?
I think one of the things you find in a lot of these homes is that they're very small. They tend to take advantage of small spaces in between buildings or next to buildings. A lot of times these are built because there's disputes over property. So in order to get back at somebody else, they'll, you know, build right along the front of the property line or build in an alley as a way to sort of get back at someone and inconvenience them. So small tends to be one of the main features.
And that was the story with the Boston skinny house. What's the story behind that?
Well, that was built by a Civil War vet to get back at his brother. He was promised a big plot of land that actually they were going to split. And unfortunately, when he was away at war, his brother basically built on about 3/4 of the land. So in order to get back at his brother, he took out the remaining plot, which people thought wouldn't be developable, and built an incredibly small, thin, tiny home to sort of piss him off, basically.
There's another one in Cambridge that's also a little teeny tiny home just sort of squished into a lot. What's the story behind that one?
Yeah, that one was built by Francis O'Reilly in 1908. He was trying to sell a little plot of land he had that someone wouldn't buy. So when they rejected his offer to sort of anger them and anger the people around them, he just built this little home, which is actually, as far as I know, still being used as an interior decorator's office. So it has found a use beyond just this guy's sense of revenge.
There are other spite homes that are defined not so much by their structure, but by their paint jobs. What are some of the examples of that?
Yeah, there's a couple of my favorite. There's one in Topeka, Kansas, that's actually located right across from the Westboro Baptist Church, which not surprisingly was painted in rainbow colors by a man named Andrew Jackson, which I think is a great form of revenge. But I would have to say, of all these homes I've written about, my favorite is one in Kensington, which is a real upscale neighborhood in London. A woman had planned to renovate her basement, and neighbors found out, brought it to the attention of the planning council, and her plans were rejected. So her revenge was to paint kind of garish red stripes on the front of her white house. And as sort of like a final like sort of twist in the revenge, she left the last stripe unfinished. So walking by, I have to see this, you know, little part unfinished, and kind of just digs into their head the whole, you know, for days and days.
Yeah, there is just a sort of like a image of, you know, people pulling up in their raised fists, you know, against these spite houses.
Right. Yeah, or coming by with a paintbrush wanting to finish it, but not being able to.
Well, it seems like, okay, yeah, have you ever heard that expression, harboring a resentment is like taking poison and waiting for the other person to die?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. But there's a kind of like, there, it's a lot of time and money and planning must go into creating a spite house. I mean, any sense that it's satisfying for them, the builders?
You know, I think for the people, especially for the people who do paint jobs, I think it sort of is, because, you know, in a lot of ways, you don't actually have to look at it. But the other people who are building sort of small homes, it seems just painful at best. If people have the money to do this and not really care about where they're living, then I think they do get a certain degree of satisfaction. The story that kind of started this all for me was there was a New York Times essay about what's called the Pink House, which is also in Massachusetts. A man, you know, in his sort of agreement with his wife, he promised to build her a replica of their home when they got divorced. What she didn't specify was where the home was. So we ended up building this in the middle of a salt marsh. So it was completely isolated. I think he got a little bit of satisfaction with that because he actually didn't have to live there.
Yeah, a lot of people talk about that home because it's on the way out to Plum Island.
Exactly.
And that is the thing, you know, that these homes must become sort of legendary in places.
Yeah, I think they've all become, you know, sort of tourist attractions, things like that in their areas. I mean, who wouldn't want to see such a weird, crazy contraption?
I was looking at the photos inside of Boston Skinny House and thinking, very attractive, actually, on the inside. Now that there's this movement of people who are living in smaller spaces, are some of these spite houses acting against their owners' original wishes and actually becoming desirable places instead of those with the big middle finger?
You know, I haven't heard of anybody deliberately, you know, going out of their way to buy or live in one of these homes. But yeah, I think you're onto something. I think the tiny home trend would suggest that these are actually maybe ahead of their time in a way.
Oh, can you ever imagine building one of these yourself?
I think if I was that angry at someone, I'd want to get as far away as I could.
Well, Patrick, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Patrick Sisson, he's news editor at Curbed, where he wrote the article Spite Houses, 12 Homes Created with Anger and Angst. And you can find a link to see all of those houses and his narrative to them. The link is at wordofmouthradio.org. From The Guardian to The New York Times to El País to Le Monde, the New Hampshire primary brings in reporters from all over the world. This year, those weathered journalists will see a new, fresh face in the scrum. Sean Hurley brings us the story.
Caitlin Clark won't show me the room she writes her stories in. Her older sister Jillian and father, Ben, explain.
You don't want to see her desk.
No.
She is truly the most messy person I have ever.
Remember, we're talking about your sister.
I know. She's horribly messy.
Messy, and still a little shocked, 2 months on, from being chosen to be a kid reporter, the only one from New Hampshire, for Scholastic News and its estimated 25 million classroom readers.
Sometimes it really shocks me. I'll just think about it and I'll be like, wow, this is kind of like, wow. So there are over 200 applicants and in the 30s of people who are picked. So yeah. Why the one girl from the tiny school in the tiny town of New Hampshire?
Scholastic editor Suzanne McCabe, who chose each of the 32 kid reporters, can answer that question.
Caitlin really seemed to have such a natural voice, and she loved news, and she said she had written for her school paper, so she thought this would give a spark to her writing.
Caitlin not only wrote for the school newspaper, the Linwood Courier, she was also one of its founding members.
I really like to write, so in fourth grade, my friends and I started up a newspaper. We would make 150 printouts, printed it out and handed it out to every kid.
So when her social studies teacher passed out the 8-page kid reporter application in October, Caitlin didn't hesitate.
I love watching the news, and I wanted to feel the experience of being on the other side telling the news.
So far, Caitlin has written 2 articles for Scholastic. Here's the opening to her first story, Snowmaking Behind the Scenes.
How can you ski if there's no snow? When the temperature is unseasonably warm and no snow falls from the sky, experts go out at night to make artificial snow. These people are called snowmakers. One such expert is Ken Mack, the manager of snowmaking at Loon Mountain Ski Resort in Lincoln, New Hampshire. Starting at the age of 10, Mack would groom the slopes to the local mountain every weekend with his grandpa Roy. Using a specialized machine called a groomer, grandfather and grandson would move and flatten the snow to make it easier to ski.
Her stories are pretty clean, so there's very little editing of Caitlin. She's a great writer. And her stories have so much charm in addition to, you know, being well-written and accurate and a distinctive voice.
And, McCabe says, Caitlin is one of the most politically well-informed 11-year-olds she's ever worked with. She's already written a story on the New Hampshire primary, and she's prepping for her next story on the Republican town hall in Nashua.
I want to see what they want to do for the economy. So last year, my social studies teacher had my friend and I go to a big constitutional meeting about the debt ceiling and what we should do about it. So that got me really interested into the economy of our nation.
Caitlin's father, Ben, says news and politics are a daily part of life in the Clark household.
My wife is a Democrat and I'm a Republican, so she has the unique opportunity to hear both sides of most major issues. And every evening at the dinner table, we'll go back and forth. And first she can hear my wife's perspective, and then, of course, I can set Caitlin straight after the fact.
Do you find yourself agreeing more with your mom or your dad? Or
my mom. Definitely my mom.
Really?
But she's unbiased, correct?
Yes.
Do you find that tricky?
Yeah, I got big opinions.
You do?
Yeah.
Big opinions and even bigger dreams.
When I went to Disney when I was very young, a first or second grader, and my dad wanted to go see this big show about presidents, and I asked, where are the girls? And he said, there's never been a girl president. So since then, I've always wanted to be a president because I'm a girl.
But before she becomes the first girl president, Caitlin Clark has to get through sixth grade and finish her year-long stint as a kid reporter. For NHPR, I'm Sean Hurley.
Thanks so much for spending some time with us today, and just a reminder that you can listen anytime you would like with the Word of Mouth podcast. You can subscribe at wordofmouthradio.org or search Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes or on Stitcher. And if you enjoy the podcast, please go public, show us some love, and write a review. It'll help others find it, all word of mouth style. It'll only take a few minutes, and there are hours to go before kickoff. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
Megan Tan,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our volunteer is Pam Maroney. The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.